About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Brian O'Keefe, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Campeche's baby tarpon. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Brian O'Keefe about Campeche's baby tarpon. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish, big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's www.flatstime.com. Well, before we introduce Brian, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. We'll be drawing for a 3-year membership for the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. Now, you have 2 chances to win tonight in the drawing. If you haven't registered yet, go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Brian's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners for the drawing at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado, which you can redeem either at their shop or on their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. Here's how you win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question's going to be about something we talked about tonight, about tarpon or campeche or something along those lines. Just submit your question along with your name and location. You have to have both, all 3 of those things, on the text box on our homepage, the same place you can ask questions during the show. So we'll do that at the end of the show. Listen closely, be fast, and you'll maybe win that $20 gift certificate. Our guest speaker tonight is Brian O'Keefe. Brian has been serious about fly fishing for the past 30 years. At age 8, Brian's interest in fly fishing was born while spending summers in Montana with his grandparents. There he was taught the art of fly casting and fishing by his grandfather. His interest in photography began as a means to back up with pictures what his family thought might just be tall tales. Brian is an accomplished fly caster, earning the title of Master Certified Fly Casting Instructor from the Fly Fishing Federation. And he is also placed and won many fly casting competitions. He has traveled to some of the wildest and most remote angling destinations in the world, including Bikini Atoll, the Seychelles Islands, Kenya, Sierra Leone, Tonga, Cuba, Kashmir, and also Mexico, as we're going to talk about tonight. He's also traveled to more accessible locations such as the Bahamas, Belize, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Chile, New Zealand, Christmas Island, and more. Today, Brian lives in Oregon and continues to work as an angling and outdoor photographer, having had photographs published in periodicals such as the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, Miami Herald, USA Today, and many others. He has covered shots in Field and Stream, Outdoor Life, Fly Fisherman, Fly Rod and Reel, Fly Fishing Salt Waters, Fly and Fish Magazine, Outside Magazine, and Men's Journal. And I meant to say had cover shots on all those magazines. Well, Brian, thanks for joining us on Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and welcome back.
Thank you very much, Roger. It's good to be back.
Yeah, we last talked with Brian about bonefish in the Bahamas, and it's been probably over a year now, and we've had lots of shows in between, but Brian's always fun to talk to. But, Brian, I got to expose some of your how hard a life you have up there in Oregon. And he just wrote me a note, folks, that said he just got off the Deschutes River fishing a, what, salmon fly hatch?
Yeah, the hatch is a little late this year due to our cold and lengthy, well, winter or spring, depending on what you define it as. And the salmon flies are still out. The golden stones are thick, and some of the big adult salmon flies are still hanging around. It was great fishing.
And tell the folks about the other places you've been in the past month and a half, the hardships you've endured there.
Oh, I know. It's been brutal. I've had a couple magazine and photo assignments to the Bahamas, where we did a charter boat and toured around some outer and real remote islands in the Bahamas and found some great flats. And then I joined a movie crew that's doing a interesting and should be excellent film, actually filmed in film, not digital. And that was in Belize, focusing on permit. And we fished down in Punta Gorda, down at Turner Flats, and had just a great time. And then I went and did a photo essay and just got back from that in Baja at a Hotel Punta, Colorado. And we focused rooster fish there and had a great time. So I've had sort of back-to-back-to-back great trips.
Sounds like it. Boy, that's just to make all you folks jealous out there. I know Brian gets to fish some great places. And we've got a show coming up on rooster fish. Fishing the surf for rooster fish here next month, so that ought to be fun.
Yeah.
Well, let's get talking about baby tarpon. I've got lots of questions tonight, Brian. First one comes from Frank in Lanceville, British Columbia, and he wants to know, where is Campeche? Probably a lot of people don't know.
Yeah, it's not a real well-known city, and it's also a state. There's 31 states in Mexico, and Campeche would be one of the states on the Yucatan Peninsula. If you envisioned how southeast Mexico, the Gulf of Mexico, and then the mainland Mexico comes up, and the Yucatan Peninsula is formed, Cancun would be on the far east side, and Campeche is on the west side of the peninsula, and Merida farther up north. So it's a Gulf of Mexico city in the state of Campeche.
That is kind of where recently that hurricane kind of came close by there, didn't it?
Yeah, it grazed it, but nothing was really damaged in that area. So it looks just as exactly how it did.
Good, good. Well, what's and if you were going to go there, what's the best way to get there, plane-wise?
Well, I think the way we went was very convenient. We left Houston, Texas, for only an hour and 35-minute flight to Merida. And at Merida, after customs and immigration, we were greeted by a representative from Tarpon Town Anglers and driven by van an hour to hour and a half down the coast from Merida to Campeche to our hotel.
Okay, so most of the guide services will pick you up in Merida then? Is that pretty standard procedure?
Yeah, I believe so. Now, I've only fished with one outfitter, and that's Raul Consonatus with Tarpon Town, and he definitely has a really nice schedule with hotel transfers and hotel-to-boat transfers all packaged together and lots of options. And it's kind of nice to have such a short flight, and it is sort of strange in a way, because you go from kind of the hustle and bustle of our airports, and then it's such a short flight to then all of a sudden be in a different but great culture, different climate, and be an hour and 35 minutes away from literally knocking on the door to some fantastic baby tarpon fishing.
Well, what's it like in Campeche? Is it a town? Is it a city, would you say?
It's a good-sized city of, I'm going to kind of guesstimate, 275,000. But it has a feel of a much smaller town. It was, it was really settled originally by Spanish conquistadors in 1540, I believe, somewhere around then. So it's an ancient city in a way, but... And it's part of UNESCO's World Heritage Site. UNESCO is the United Nations Education, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, and they've designated the central area, the plaza area of Campeche, to be a World Heritage Site due to its architecture and cultural importance. And when you walk through town, I'm not kidding, Roger, you would think you were on a Hollywood movie set and that someone with a wild imagination designed these buildings, painted them these colors, and you would say, well, in 2 weeks they'll tear it down and it'll be a movie lot. But Campeche is stunningly beautiful, culturally important, and it just, it's what I think brings people back. The fishing obviously is great. We had fantastic baby tarpon fishing. But it was really the town, the people, and some of the Mayan ruins, the food, we'll go into that later, is just unbelievable. Combined with great fishing and a great outfitter, made it really, really a memorable trip. If I was to describe the city, like right now, if you were standing in the plaza, there'd be 2- and 3-story buildings, multicolored, lots of arches, interesting colonial architecture, cobbled streets, a plaza in the center of, say, 2 acres with kids playing, little bands, very, very colorful, completely safe. I'm even sort of reluctant to say that because it's almost insulting. Campeche's a very, very safe town, and I almost regret saying that because it's almost insulting. It's just a fantastic place for families and places to bring kids and things like that. So, colors, great climate, interesting architecture, your eyes and mind wander back and forth. Everything's just a beautiful sight.
Sounds like a photographer's paradise there, or visually speaking.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you couldn't take a bad picture in Campeche, unless it's maybe a torrential rainstorm, but that might be interesting also. Yeah, it's got all the architecture, the colors, fantastic. There's very few modern buildings in downtown Campeche, so many of these buildings are 300 or more years old, and it's just absolutely fascinating.
So it sounds like there's more to do than just fishing there as far as being a tourist and enjoying some history and architecture and so forth.
Yeah, I think it's a destination for people who appreciate history, for one thing, and the Mayan culture because of the nearby ruins like Edna, which is closer than an hour's drive, with just amazing Mayan ruins. And, you know, I've been in situations where I've seen big ruins and been in those kinds of areas before. And this time, I actually hired a guide. And I think I've just been a little bit too cheap to do that in the past, just kind of wander around, take pictures, do my own thing. And this time I decided, what the heck, I'm going to hire a guide. And it was money well spent. It wasn't very much. But to learn what the different buildings and pavilions and structures were used for, the dates people lived there, what they grew in their fields, how they transported water, it's all very, very fascinating. And I highly recommend that. And people who have an appreciation for great food would go to Campeche just for that. It's unbelievable. As an example, it's obviously a coastal town, so there's a lot of fish. Also has a big shrimp industry there. And in some of the nice little restaurants, we would order, well, actually one person in our party was a big guy, and he would order 2 dinners because he just couldn't stand having one. But my favorite was a nice filet of cobia, and in the kitchen they put crab and shrimp meat and some cheese and spice inside, rolled it up, held it together with toothpicks, they covered it in a verde sauce and baked it, and I am not kidding, it's worth the whole trip. And we went to restaurant after restaurant where the food was all excellent, and it's a type or style of food that you wouldn't find here. I mean, we can go out and have Mexican food, or, I mean, there's restaurants near where I live that are Peruvian, that sort of thing, but that Mayan style is different, very unique, and the flavors are very hard to describe, but kind of an earthy, smoky kind of Chipotle type flavor, and I'm getting hungry just thinking about it.
Good. Yeah, sounds like it. We've got a question here from Joanne. She's in California on the Central Coast. She wants to know what time of year is best for the baby tarpon down there, and what's the weather like at that time of year?
Okay, the guides that I've dealt with have recommended April to September as the prime months, and those obviously are going to be fairly warm. There might be some afternoon rain showers. It's a year-round tarpon fishery, so sometimes our fishing trips or vacations are dictated by work schedules or school vacations or whatever, so I would not be afraid to go to Campeche at any time, because you're always going to have fairly nice weather. It's not a real windy place, although the wind blows. It's on the ocean, so you're going to have occasional wind. But because of the big backcountry mangrove area, you can always duck out of the wind and fish the mangrove lagoons. If you're a school teacher, then you've got prime time all summer long to go. But as an average fisherman like myself, I would go in the middle of the winter, enjoy the tarpon fishing, the city and the ruins, and make it a great package.
So there is no particular, like you said, the tarpon are in the water there all the time. They're not moving through, migrating, or anything like that.
No, they'll grow up, and at a certain point, migrate out.
Okay.
And the guides have found some areas with some bigger tarpon, but most of the fish are 5 to 35 pounds, probably around a 15-pound average, maybe. So those are your immature tarpon that are growing up in this area, in the Bay of Campeche, and then at a certain point they will move on. I don't think a lot is known or understood about the habits at that point of where they go, but for all we know, they could go all the way to Florida, over to Cuba, down to Belize, who knows, but it's got a lot of smaller to medium-sized tarpon there year-round.
Okay, well, let's talk more about them in a minute. A couple more questions on the area. Mike in Pearland, Texas, wants to know, for an angler on a budget, is it better to book a guide and then arrange for lodging and food on your own? Or, you know, do you think the package deal is the better buy?
Yeah, and we're all kind of looking for a deal here and there, so I understand the question very well, but I think in Campeche it's better off to go with an outfitter. And then, well, mainly because they're fairly busy, and to go all that way and then not be able to find a guide is pretty disappointing. So I would line up your fishing, save up for that, but there are so many different accommodation options that you don't have to go to a 5-star hotel. There are some. They're absolutely gorgeous. But there's some mid-price and lower-price and even some hostels that have sort of dormitory-style accommodations. And if a person was to contact the Campeche tourist people, and I think their website is just CampecheTravel.com.
CampecheTravel.com?
Yeah, they produce a beautiful booklet on all the fishing, the cultural aspects of the state, and a good accommodation, a restaurant guide. And so saving money, easy to do through accommodations, but I would save up for a good outfit or take advantage of that.
Yeah, I suppose it's probably the kind of place where you pretty much need a boat to fish, right? And
yeah, really, you really do. They're cruising fish when they're outside the mangrove, and they're in small pods of 5 to 20 fish, and they're moving, rolling, and the guide's pole kind of keep up with the fish or get into a position to make the cast, and it's just, well, I guess not impossible. You could maybe do it in the kayak, but it's really best with a good guide. They really work hard. I've never seen guides pull and push all day as long and as hard as I have with the guides in Campeche.
We need to take a break here, but when we come back, we'll talk with Brian more about fly fishing in Mexico for baby tarpon. At Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut, and and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spinfish fishing guide trips for warm water species as well. Please tour our website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Brian O'Keefe about Campeche's baby tarpon. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let's see here. We've got... Oh, this is kind of an oddball question, so I'll just throw it out there, Brian. This came in on the Internet. You don't know a Rich Salachka in Maple Glen, Pennsylvania, do you?
Not yet.
Okay. He says, hey, some of these questions you never know if it's a friend, you know, kind of goading you or whatever. But he wants to know what your most scariest event fly fishing was.
That's a great question. I've had a couple, and some of the stories are way too long. I could take up the entire rest of your show, but just a couple weeks ago, down in Belize, I took a movie camera and a single scuba tank down to about, well, we ranged between 45 and 60 feet to film schools of permit in their deep water phase, and it was a rough, stormy day. I dropped in, and this isn't fly fishing, but this is part of making a fly fishing film. So, dropped in, spent 45 minutes underwater, came up, and there's no boat. They'd lost my bubbles, and they were searching for me somewhere else, and I spent 3 or so hours swimming against the tide, then through slack tide, and a little bit with the tide. Missed the bottom of the Turnip Islands, was drifting out towards Cuba, and I saw a small little reef with a pole on it with a light, and I managed to swim over to that and eventually was rescued, or it would have been, I think, the big swim.
Oh, gosh. Oh. I've dove there. You must have been in that big channel out there between Turnip and, what is it, Lighthouse?
Well, yeah, at the bottom of the Turnip Islands, there's a rather famous scuba area called the Elbow. And I must admit, it is just absolutely gorgeous, and it's a fantastic dive. But, yeah, we just had a little bad luck there. But this is the fun part, Roger. I do a lot of float tubing, and I found that if I inflated my buoyancy compensator just a little bit and I got into a backstroke, I could kick for hours, and I realized I was using the same muscles that I use in my float tube, and I really think that's what kind of saved my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. There's a story and more to come in the future, it sounds like.
Well, and we can
hopefully they all turn out good.
Yeah, there's a lot more in Sierra Leone and bears in Alaska, but that's just part of fly fishing. That's just the normal stuff.
Yeah. There's kind of a follow-up question on the booking guides down there. Wilf in Vancouver Island, British Columbia, is thinking about going down there with his wife, wants to know if he could hire a fly fishing guide for 2 or 3 times a week. In other words, I guess do a little sightseeing, a little fishing, a little sightseeing. What would you say to that? Is that...
Well, I would say that'd be like hiring a guide just about anywhere in kind of an erratic way or pattern on the calendar. It's just a little bit harder. It's throwing a curveball at the guide, him having to kind of work those open dates between dates.
Right.
In a perfect world, you know, try to get your days 3 or 4 in a row. You're going to want to do as many as you can once you get there because it's just fun all day long. It's nonstop. But he's on the right track with doing the other things because just going there, going to your hotel, going out in the boats, coming back to the hotel, it's a shame. So hitting the ruins and the town and the restaurants is, well, you know, Roger, I'm a pretty hardcore fisherman, but on one day towards the end of our trip, we caught a ton of fish. We actually asked the guide to go in early so we could get back into town and do a few more things in the city that we hadn't seen yet. So it's a great combination.
Yeah. Well, he mentions taking a 2-week trip, so maybe he should fish 1 week and tour the other week, and then he'll satisfy both needs there. So.
Yeah, I think that would be a great plan. And I should mention one more thing. When people think of the Yucatan and they've seen, you know, Cancun, Cozumel, even down the coast to Ascension Bay, you know, beautiful coastline with coconut trees and sandy beaches and blue water. On the Campeche side, well, that's the largest turtle grass, basically, a flat or a bay in the world. So it doesn't have the white sand beaches. It has a seawall and mangrove. So it's a different look than say, Cancun, thank goodness. And an interesting statistic is Cancun gets as many tourists in one day as Campeche gets in a whole year. So you're not going to see big tour buses and thousands of people, sunburned tourists all over. It's a different kind of tourist destination. Again, people that appreciate the culture, food, and that sort of thing. So.
Right,
I love
right.
beaches. There's a few little ones, but it's primarily fishing and the town and the ruins.
Okay. Question from Pat Oglesby over in Grand Junction, Colorado. Would you recommend this location for a first-time tarpon fisher? And what skill level of casting is required?
Well, I do know Pat, and he's definitely a good enough caster. it's a really good place for a first-time tarpon fishing because it's just sort of like you shrunk down big tarpon fishing. It's the same leading the fish type cast, angle of cast to the fish. It's the same strip strike, jumps, a little bow with the rod. It's just sort of a miniature scale of the big tarpon fishing. So I think there's probably no better place to go and learn the habits, the strike, the jumps of tarpon.
Let me kind of throw this out there, because I went tarpon fishing for the first time down in Key West last year. I went down with my father and my son, and my son was lucky to hook up twice and land one, I don't know, 100, 110 pounds, somewhere in that area. I didn't. I had a lot of cast to fish, but for the big ones, it seems like they're few and far between. Would you have, again, starting as a first-time fly fisher, are you going to get more fish on down in Campeche than you would, say, down in the Keys, like where we were fishing?
Well, probably, and I think, you know, there's a mathematical equation of, you know, when you're fishing baby tarpon, it's more about good, constant action. Big fish tarpon, you don't need a lot of big fish to make your day. You know, a jump.
Oh, just one.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. So with baby tarpon, there's more casting. It's just all about kind of the action. You're searching, casting, stripping flies, setting the hook, jumping fish. You know, it's the same thing, though. I mean, a one-aught, perfectly good, sharp hook with a baby tarpon is going to fly out, just like with a big fish. I think it's kind of skill building. You get your balance in the boat. You get your posture, how you like to stand when you strip, so you can do a good strip set. And you work out little kinks and foibles before, you know, going after big fish.
Right, right. Joanne, and again from California, wants to know, are there other species that you might fish for in Campeche besides tarpon?
You know, there's a few, but you'll get hooked on the baby tarpon. So we found in some sort of potholes in the ocean side, which is a 3 to 7 foot deep, huge area, all turtle grass bottom, crystal clear glass, glass-like water. And in these potholes, there were snapper, I think mostly gray snapper. And there was a few barracuda. Occasionally they catch a snook. But you're kind of geared up for tarpon. And when the action's going on, you just go from pod to pod, from school to school, And as much as I like multiple species fishing, you get pretty hooked on the baby tarpon.
Okay, okay. Now, Bill in San Carlos, California asks, first he makes a comment that he's had the pleasure of fishing for Yucatan baby tarpon and said they're a hoot. But then he asks, what's the health of the tarpon fishery around Campeche? does the Mexican government manage it as a sport fishing resource as they should? Do you see evidence of that?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I wholeheartedly would say yes, they very much take care of it, know the importance of it. Now, from Campeche going up the coast towards Merida, towards the point of the Yucatan, it's about 80 uninterrupted miles of mangrove, which means or translates into maybe 1,000 miles of shoreline when you count all the bays and estuaries and lakes and islands. If you fished a real twisty, windy creek as the crow flies, you might have only gone 400 yards, but you fished a mile of river. And in those mangrove backcountry areas, which is the nursery of tarpon and other fish, I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of miles there are of shoreline with the mangrove and all, but it's a huge area. It is a bioreserve. So with only limited numbers of outfitters, and then that would mean limited numbers of anglers and no commercial fishing allowed, I think it's a protected and a very strong fishery that should hold up for years to come.
Good, good. I always like to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the tarpon more specifically. This is a kind of a nursery area, you said. Are there, now, as I understand it, we've got tarpon in the Caribbean, and where else in the world will we find tarpon? And are there any particular places that are, other places that are known for baby tarpon?
Yeah, historically, tarpon are an Atlantic species. Since the Panama Canal, there have been a few tarpon that have moved around the corner and are in the Pacific, but that's very incidental. So, as an Atlantic species, their range would go, say, let's use Campeche to start with, and heading south or southwest down the Gulf around Veracruz and then up the Gulf of Mexico to Texas. Well, we've got tarpon down there. We've got tarpon in Louisiana, Alabama, all through Florida, of course, and up the other side of Florida. Believe it or not, they have actually had tarpon, and they have been recorded in Nova Scotia. Now, that's very rare, probably a Gulf Stream thing that spawned the perfect storm. But they do range up and down the Atlantic, coast of the United States, out to the Bahamas, Cuba, all through the chain of islands in the Caribbean to Trinidad and Tobago, down around the corner, and then all the way over on the other side in Africa. So tarpon are well distributed all around the Atlantic. And some places are known for big fish, like Florida, Africa, parts of Cuba. Other places are known for smaller fish, which would be the Yucatan, although some places on the Yucatan do have some fairly large fish, up to 100 pounds. And then down into Belize, you have a combination of baby tarpon and mid-sized tarpon and a few big fish. And then Nicaragua, just down we go into Venezuela, where there's a good baby tarpon fishery in Rio Chico, and also some big tarpon, including some very big tarpon that were caught earlier, back in the 30s and 40s in Lake Maracaibo, that were over 200 pounds. So they're all over the place.
Well, that's we did have a question from Fabian in Argentina, in fact, wanting to know about baby tarpon in Venezuela. So he said there is a nursery down there, so to speak, but also some large ones, right?
That's right. I fished Rio Chico, and it was mangrove baby tarpon fishing, just like kind of everywhere else. And I never really saw the big fish that Venezuela is known for. I think that might have been a fishery that's, I don't know if it's been fished out, but you don't hear about it much anymore. And the Rio Chico area is very similar to Campeche, with mangrove islands and lagoons, and it's under the mangrove, kind of bass-style casting with light rods and good action. And if a person's on vacation in Venezuela, they could do Los Rocas for bonefish and then drop down and do Rio Chico for baby tarpon.
Ah, good. Sounds like a good trip.
Yeah.
Now, do they know how the tarpon spawn? I mean, how do the fry get into these mangroves and how the whole thing starts? Or is that a mystery like so many fish?
Well, it's a mystery to me, and it might be a question for someone else, but it's just in fisherman speak, I've heard that after about 7 years, a tarpon is mature to spawn, and the last I've either read or talked about were fish that move out to deeper water, blue water sometimes, and spawn. A big fish of, say, 140 pounds will have 12 million eggs, so there's got to be a fair amount of mortality among eggs, small fish, etc., juvenile fish. And eventually, these fish move into mangrove area where they're safe, where they find a good food supply, and they spend about 6 years in that area before reaching sexual maturity and then moving on. And I did a trip to Africa where we collected some samples of fish of different sizes, and some of the information we got back was one of our fish, which was, I think, around 180 pounds, was 50 years old. So they live a long time. And so if they they can spawn at 50 years, I mean, I'm sorry, if they can spawn at 7 years old, they have a long life of spawning left in them. So, and most tarpon are released as far as food quality. I mean, I've never tasted it, but I don't know anybody that really thinks of tarpon as a food fish, even in some of the more remote countries and areas. So, I don't know if I dodged around that question too much, but those are a spattering of statistics or fishermen speak that might, you know, shed a little light on that.
Right, right. So there must be some larger, I would think, than larger tarpon spawning outside these mangroves. We talk about baby tarpon, but there's got to be big tarpon to make baby tarpon. Right?
Oh, yeah. You know, usually about day three, that enters your mind. It's like, okay, here's the young, where are the mature fish? And Raul, who owns Tarpon Town Anglers, he has found places, but it takes either a super long boat ride or a camp out or a live aboard to go fish those spots. And, you know, we're still kind of working on that. I almost had a trip with Raul put together to a small island to camp out and explore some areas for these bigger fish. And we're just working on some logistics, and I'll keep you posted on that.
Yeah, sounds like that might be a hidden treasure around the corner, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Just on the other side of that mangrove island.
Well, they're out there somewhere.
They've got to be, yeah. Well, what are the, in Campeche, what are these tarpon feeding on in the mangroves there?
Well, I would think it's a variety of things, but shrimp would be a real common food. Tarpon, I would say if you had to rate their favorite food worldwide, it would be mullet. Other bait fish, crabs, shrimp, and that'll keep them going. But since Campeche has a booming shrimp industry, I would have to think that shrimp would be a very important part of their diet.
You had kind of mentioned, I think you already said there's no commercial fishing there, and are there slot limits of any kind? Can you keep fish there, or is it all catch and release?
As far as I know, it's all catch and release. In fact, Raul has implemented a no fish in the boat policy for photos and things like that. So when you catch a fish, you can lip it, take your fly out, maybe slide a hand under the belly and hold it up over the water for a quick photo, and then release. So as an individual, he's really forward thinking about taking care of all the fish in that area.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Well,
I know I was going to ask you that later in the show about taking photographs, but I know with the larger tarpon, you just, It's very damaging to move the fish into the boat, and also could be dangerous for yourself. You know, you get 100 pounds of fish flopping around in the boat. I was kind of wondering about the smaller ones as well, so it looks like they're being very careful down there.
Oh, yeah, I think they're doing a great job.
As far as setting up for a shot, kind of walk us through what would you, as a photographer, how would you set up that shot of the tarpon and the fly fisher?
Well, I would, once the boat is sort of staked out so the guy could put the pole in the bottom and hold it tight, get an angle with the sun at the photographer's back, lean over the side of the boat just a little bit, and now with digital cameras where you don't always have to look right through the little eyepiece, and you can either read off the back or just position the camera by hand, I'd shoot kind of low to the water, have an angler, let's say he's using his right hand to just do a simple tail grab like you would on a trout or steelhead, an index finger and thumb grab on the tail, and a little lift on the belly and get him parallel to the water, just an inch out of the water, and a couple quick shots. and maybe angle the fish just a little to the sun if it's early in the morning, or down away from the sun so it's not too bright. Sometimes those bright tarpon scales will just blow a picture out, especially digital. And so maybe a little angle of the fish, maybe the head towards the photographer a little bit, a little angle that just takes seconds, click, click, back in the water, a little revive and let go.
Sounds good, sounds good.
Yeah.
Brian, we have to take another little break here, but we'll be right back, talk about equipment, flies, and some strategies here. So hang tight, folks. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. Is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today, so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Are you listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio? We're talking with Brian O'Keefe about Campeche's baby tarpon. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use our Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Brian, equipment. John French in California wants to know what size rod and leader setup you use for baby tarpon.
Okay, I usually take a couple rods, and we're not talking about world record fish, so I don't use an IGFA leader. I'd rather have a long shock tippet of, say, 2 to 2.5 feet. I usually use 30 to 40 pound fluorocarbon, and I use a uni knot to connect that to a very basic but fairly short tapered leader of, say, 4 feet. 4 to 5 feet, and it would be, say, 35, 40 pound shock to 15 to 20 pound tapered leader, fairly heavy butt leader. The reason for two rods is one is a straight floating line for the shallow areas, especially in the mangrove. That rod, really, if you're an experienced fisherman, I would say you could go as light as a 6 weight. But an 8 is probably the all-round rod. 8 or 9 would be perfect. The set and some initial sort of steering the fish away from mangrove roots and things like that does take a sort of a heavy action rod, but it doesn't have to be, you know, a heavy weighted rod like a 10 or something like that. So 6 to 8 for the canopy and mangrove fishing, floating lines, sort of short, stout leaders. Might as well just complete the whole thing with flies back in the mangrove. Nothing real big, you know, smaller 2.5, 3 inch traditional tarpon flies like the cockroach, seducers. I'm just trying to think, any bait fish patterns, even some poppers or gurglers, black and red, purple and black, that sort of thing. 1-aught and 2-aught is fine. And watch your back cast. In fact, the other people in the boat should sort of be giving pointers on, you know, 3 feet to the mangrove, because the back cast can be really tight. I mean, it's just a sort of a walled canopy, and some sidearm casting is very important, even a sort of a tuck roll cast to put a little fly back under the mangrove. Many times you'll see the fish in the mangrove. There's some blind casting, which is fun, just working the shoreline every 5, 6 feet, putting it back into a little cove or dark spot or a place where there's an opening into another bay. If you're in a inside lagoon and there's a shallow little maybe 20 foot tunnel through the mangrove to another lake or lagoon, that area there is almost a guaranteed spot for baby tarpon. So that's when the fish are moving in into the lagoons, into the mangrove. But in other tides and situations, more fish will be out on the open flats, the 3 to 7 foot flats. And out there, again, 9 foot rod, 7, 8, or 9, but I like a clear tip line or like a Streamer Express line with a clear tip. It'll sink a foot or two. It's very stealthy. It shoots like crazy, and just like a little bit of sink there when you're fishing in that 6 foot depth. Many fish are rolling. You don't have to have a clear tip or wet tip line, or even a full like tarpon taper line, which is almost clear. But it is kind of handy, and they do load and cast quickly, and they're pretty stealthy. So, open water fishing, kind of like a little bit of sink, but back in the mangrove, full floating's great.
Okay. Anything you look for in particular with the reel?
You know, not really.
Okay.
I wouldn't take a standard trout reel, but just a basic from steelhead or better reel, something you can wash off. I think there's good reels now in almost all price categories, and to a degree, a true tarpon reel is overkill. And you know, if you're fishing for 5 to 15 pound fish, occasional 20 pounder, and then occasional 30 pounder that shocks you, just comes out of nowhere, out of the mangrove, is jumping all over the place. In fact, my last big fish down there jumped into the mangrove, swung around in the overhanging limbs, finally broke the leader, and, you know, that's just hilarious stuff. And I can't describe the fire drill that goes on when that happens, but occasional pretty nice fish, but again, a person who's had some experience with the strip set strike for tarpon can use a 6 weight, especially in the mangrove. But on the open water, 8 weight, pretty fast action. And let me just throw in one more thing. On the open water, and still it's not deep, it's shallow, you can see the bottom, but you're being pulled along with pods of fish, or trying to cut off a pod of fish that's moving through, and you want to get in position to make a nice cast. If you have sort of intermediate level casting skills, you're probably going to do better back in the mangrove, where it's more accuracy and 20 to 45 foot casts, not much wind. If you can lay it out there, I mean a 60 to 90 foot caster, your score is going to increase exponentially with your casting ability. And so at that juncture, that's that 8 weight rod that starts to really put out some nice distance and fast loading and shooting a lot of line. So if you want to really do well at Campeche, I would say, and you want to improve your casting, take a couple lessons or work in the yard and get a nice, quick, say, 80-foot cast, and you'll do a lot better on that open water.
There, you had mentioned earlier when you were talking about your leader and shock tippet setup, use a uni knot to tie the two together. Was that correct?
Yeah, there's a couple different connection knots. I just go pretty darn simple, and since fluorocarbon is not a real large diameter, even at 40 pounds, I could do a uni knot to a 15 to 20 pound tapered leader in just seconds and jam it up, and it works great. And
we have a question from Frank in Lanceville, British Columbia again about specialized knots like a Bimini twist. You hear a lot about that. Is that necessary for that kind of fishing?
No, absolutely okay. Not. The trout and steelhead knots will work just fine for baby tarpon. For the fly, I use a uni loop knot. For heavier shock tippet, I use the Homer Road loop knot. Basically, you know, we're talking about smaller fish here, and you just dummy down the whole thing, kind of go into a fun mode. When you're chasing big tarpon, and I'm sure, Roger, you'll agree, you can get some knee-knocking, nervous, exciting stuff. You can, you know, you can blow casts that you would never blow if there wasn't a tarpon there. You can get yelled at by your guide. You can just be totally destroyed. But baby tarpon fishing is a kick. So it's just loose, easy going. So what if you blow a cast? There's still another pot of fish on the other side of the boat. And it's not a high-pressure deal. It's really... It's sort of
the big fish, you know, big tarpon is definitely high stress, I have to say.
Yeah.
When you see 8 fish coming towards you in a school and they're all 80 to 100 pounds, it's, I don't care how you look at it, it's pretty scary, you know.
Yeah, it makes, you have a lot more respect for a field goal kicker in the NFL in the fourth quarter because you're standing there and you feel like there's 100,000 people watching.
Exactly, exactly. Well, this, you know, it sounds like baby tarpon sounds a lot like, I think you were just going to say, bass or pike fishing.
Right.
Where you're fishing into the shorelines and so forth, and you get active, massive strikes and, you know, kind of predator kind of fish attacking the fly.
It's very, very similar in tackle, except for the shank tippet. Well, we would have that with pike.
Yeah.
And but accurate cast, tucking it under the limbs, being able to cast, shoot, and move your shooting line right to your stripping hand, and you know, being very coordinated about as soon as that fly hits, make it move so it doesn't sink and get hung up in the roots or something. And just being kind of coordinated, having good timing, also looking for movements of fish, fish rolling, and so it's good action all the time. Just like bass fishing, working a shoreline is never really all that boring. You always got something to look for, looking for a little protection area for fish, some little flash, and so never a dull moment.
Well, we've got some more questions here about flies. One question from Frank up in British Columbia again. He asked about toads and that he's read about. Did you use those down there?
Yeah, that is a great pattern. Seems to work everywhere for all sizes of fish and a lot of different species. So, a toad in tan, a toad sort of tan, light pink, toad tan and white, maybe a little bit of chartreuse mixed in, some flashaboo. Nothing too big, again, 2.5 to 3 inches, which makes it really ideal for casting. And that's a great pattern. Clousers are good in the open water. I tie up a kind of a saltwater zonker that's a bait fish pattern, and so the rabbit strip is the action, a little bit of flash on the sides, and they seem to like that just about everywhere I've been. And I'm not saying that any fly will work. It always seems like a color or size does work better than others, but a general assortment of traditional flies and then some hybrid homemade flies, you'll find ones that they really like, and then they'll just get torn apart.
Rick in Maple Glen, Pennsylvania, just wrote in on the internet and want to know, what's your favorite baby tarpon fly? So we always get that question. But is there one you put on first when you go down there?
No, not really. I'd have to say the toad is pretty darn good just about anywhere you go. And then this little zonker fly I have is just a bait fish pattern that kind of works everywhere. I use it in Baja for roosters in a bigger size. But a bait fish pattern with a little bit of action, the cockroach, darn good fly, day in, day out. And at times, I'm a real believer in red. And it might be when the water's got a little more color in it or something. Say if there's been a rain and there's more of that tea coloration back in the lagoons. And for me, a red and black fly has been bank. So I would always have a few of those, too.
Speaking of fly, do the guides, do you bring your flies, or do the guides usually have flies down there for you?
The guides will have a few flies, but they really consider it the responsibility of the angler to come prepared with the flies. They'll have some good, hard leader material for leader changes and things like that. But they're on the water every day and don't really have time to anticipate the needs of forgetful or anglers that just, maybe brought a few flies. I mean, most people I know overkill on flies. But speaking of that, I had some friends coming back from Baja that were not allowed to take their fly boxes in their carry-on luggage and or reels. And that's always been kind of a dicey issue for the last few years. But this time it was really the difference in making the flight. It was slow getting through security, and then they found a few flies, and they made these guys go back down to the ticket area to check the flies. It was really kind of a hassle, so just a word of warning, you might not want to bring big tarpon flies on your carry-on luggage. Maybe try to sneak a couple through, but they're being more and more stringent about that all the time.
Is it the large hook size? Is that what they're having a problem with?
Yeah, I think it is. And then just the unusual nature of some fly fishing equipment, hemostats. Even a fly tying vise made a real ruckus in Mexico. And, just some unusual looking items. So fly tying materials, scissors, bobbins, all that stuff is, not seen every day by those people. And I think it really draws a red flag.
Yeah, yeah. Just out of curiosity, in all your travels, do you take fly tying materials with you to tie on the road, or do you avoid that?
Oh,
have you had any problems with?
Yeah, I try to avoid it now. I used to do that. I had a great little travel fly tying kit. But I'd say I'd rather spend the time at home either tying my own flies or seeking out a fly shop or tire that has, you know, great flies for that type of fishing. In a place like Campeche, you won't have much time for tying because you're after the boat, we would, and I got to tell you straight, Roger, this was the plan. We get off the boat, walk across the street. We would rinse our reels off in the hotel fountain. It's all nice fresh water. It was very convenient. Wash the rod down. Looked a little strange. We would put those in our rooms, walk across the street, get a six-pack of Negra Modelo. We'd hit the pool and have a couple cold ones and reminisce about our day's fishing, relax, and then get organized for a walk, maybe five-minute walk from that hotel into downtown Campeche, and then have the hard decision of which restaurant to eat that night. Now, Raul at Tarpon Town purposely doesn't include a package where he has one hotel do your dinners. I'm sure you could work that out, but that would be absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
His package was quick fruit and maybe an egg breakfast at the hotel. Walk across the street, get in the boat, and we're fishing in 5 minutes. But coming back, relax, kick back, and enjoy a great dinner at a variety of restaurants around town. And I couldn't have thought of or designed a better program myself.
Good, good. A couple of last questions about flies, then we'll take a little break and come back, talk about stalking and presentation and fighting. So do you spend much time sharpening hooks? We know that hooking up is a troublesome task with tarpon. Do you spend time sharpening? Are the hooks out of the box sharp enough nowadays? What's your...
Oh, I really think the hooks are pretty darn sharp. I like a barbless hook. I was fishing today on the Deschutes, and up comes my buddy, and he yells down at me from the bank, "Brian, medical emergency." And he put a big, you know, salmon fly, dry fly, deep into his thumb. He hadn't pinched his barb down. And I used that technique where you push down and take a loop of fly line and pop it right out. He didn't feel a thing. It was great. But a tarpon fly is a different deal, and I know people have put them in various parts of their anatomy, and it's never, never a good experience, even if you can pop it out with the cod fisherman's technique or something. And penetration is half the battle with tarpon, so if you start out with a good sharp hook, get that barb down fairly flat, you want to just to get in and hold something. As you know, it's a hard kind of plated mouth structure, so it's not fleshy like a permit or a bonefish, which take the hook so well. So a little bit of luck involved. I think instead of worrying about the super sharp hook all that much, I'm more concerned about the way the fish takes the fly. If it takes it straight at me, I'm not going to do a whole lot for a while until my line comes tight, and then I'll give it a little elbow set. If it takes it on a roll and turns away, I'll just kind of stop the line. Just stop it, hold it, and give it a little jab. But not a ferocious, you know, some of the stuff I've seen on videos and TVs, it's a little theatrical in my opinion. I really think you just watch the fish. When it turns, tighten up, give it a little poke, and then the fish is immediately airborne and the fight is on. So a good sharp hook, yeah, that's pretty good. But I know some old-timers who actually kind of like a duller hook that slides in the mouth and then hooks them in the very front little fleshy part. So we could go on all day about different styles and theories on hooking tarpon, but I think just breathing, staying loose and relaxed, let the fish tighten up the line, give it a little jab, and fish on. I think people get too amped up. They see that swirl, and then boom, they strike so fast, they never give the fish a chance to actually turn, and which I think improves your hooking ability 100%.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll take a break here, Brian, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk more about Campeche's baby tarpon. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net or email them at pudge@womensflyfishing.net or call them at 907-274-7113. So that's womensflyfishing.net. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Brian O'Keefe about Campeche's baby tarpon. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Brian, tactics and strategies here. First, how does the weather affect the tarpon bite there? I assume you fished on some sunny days, some cloudy days. Is there much difference?
A little bit. The ideal day is leaving early in the morning, although the outfitter can design a trip that's sort of afternoon-oriented or morning-oriented. So if they think the tide might be better one part of the day than another, I would listen to them. But primarily you leave early in the morning, nice temperature, probably upper 70s, low 80s, and out in the boat on glassy water with no wind. That is an incredible natural phenomenon to see schools of tarpon rolling in that first morning light. And so as most tarpon fishermen have seen, that glinting silver when they're rolling, four or five flashes and then nothing, then four or five flashes, and seeing multiple schools stretching for a mile or so, and you just know you're going to be surrounded by fish. So that scenario, no wind, glassy calm, early morning, well, that's pretty hard to beat. Once you're on the fish and the sun gets a little higher, you basically just kind of stay with them and follow them, keep casting into them. And when the wind comes up, they're a little harder to see roll. They're definitely a little harder to track to see which direction they're going, that sort of thing. But it's still doable. It's not all that hard. A tremendous amount of wind would be very difficult, and there wouldn't be that many fish rolling in the first place. But that's when you duck into the mangrove and get out of that wind. Because of, you know, the latitude, you might have afternoon showers, which at times to me are quite welcome. I think it's kind of nice to rinse the salt off the boat and cool off in a big shower. But if you had a lot of overcast with no wind isn't bad. It could get a little muggy, a little humid, but overcast and wind is probably the least favorable condition. I haven't seen that yet. But then you would definitely go back in the mangrove and fish little canals, pockets, overhangs. Even blind casting is a lot of fun, and you have plenty of action. So I think there's a little something to do with all weather conditions, some just maybe a little better than others.
Now, so the first part of the day when you've got good calm conditions, theoretically, you're just scanning the surface out there looking for these rollers, and is that the way that you find them, or are you looking for birds, or is that the easiest way?
Primarily rollers. The guides are very, very good at knowing where to be and when. Sometimes it's a case of having a hunch, because once you leave town, there might be rollers just visible from the seawall, so it's a no-brainer. Let's fish here for a little while, but they might want to, talk you into or convince you to having a run of, say, a half hour or 45 minutes off, which is far away by Campeche standards, to an area where maybe they've seen more fish or bigger fish. And as an ex-guide, I generally think that, they are trying to give you the best experience possible. So, and I don't believe always in leaving fish to find fish, but if there's a few rollers in the bay and they want to move, then they know that maybe 8-10 miles down the road there are more fish and bigger fish. It kind of hurts to watch a little school go away, but I just trust the guide.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do the tides affect the bite there at all, or your location for fishing?
Yeah, I think tides are important in almost any kind of saltwater fishing. Whenever the water's moving, I think you'll find more feeding fish, more active fish. And when the tide's low, that Bay of Campeche that you fish, which is a vast, I can't even describe how big this turtle grass area is, as far as the eye can see, it gets shallow. It gets 3-4 feet deep for miles, And so at low, low tide, you've kind of compressed your fish into a smaller area. And that's when you fish farther and farther out. You move maybe a mile off the mangroves, and you'd be in that 3, 4, 5 foot depth. And there's still rolling fish or even fish you can see visually just without rolling, just because the water's so clear. As the tide comes up, those fish that are a mile out will come back in and follow that tide into the mangrove, and as the tide fills up the mangrove and it gets deep, that's when they'll move back through a circuitous channel system that if you and I were back there and the guy just jumped out of the boat and swam away, we would be back there for 300 days. They can motor around, pull through little holes, little channels and canals, and find their way in and out like there's a GPS in their head. And I just give up. I try to remember, we're going to cut through here. Well, we never do. It's just an amazing labyrinth of channels and lagoons and lakes. But as that fills up with the tide, the tarpon take advantage of it and move back in there also.
Now, are you fishing for, in general, you mentioned schools, and I know, do you generally fish into small schools, or are you fishing to individual fish at times? How does that work?
Yeah, on the outside turtle grass flats, it's small to medium-sized schools, which would mean 5 to 20 fish, sometimes more. But there might be, in an area the size of a football field, there might be 6 or 8 schools working in that area. So it's a great backup. It's kind of like taking a shot, and that's your mulligan, but don't worry about it because, you know, 40 yards up here, there's another group coming through, and you get another shot at them. As you go back into the mangrove, it's more individual fish. There will be little pods of fish, especially in key spots where one lagoon exits and then enters another lagoon. Those are always hot spots. There'll be some fish daisy chaining around in places like that or lurking in the mangrove. But when you follow a shoreline, generally it's a fish or two that are concealed under the mangrove limbs or down in the roots that you're trying to look for.
Now, you just mentioned daisy chaining, and I don't know that everybody knows what that is, so you might describe that. But do the baby tarpon act like the adult tarpon in their antics and so forth?
Well, there's a lot of similarities. When they get into a nice little area and they're real comfortable, they will just circle. And I haven't seen a classic daisy chain with small tarpon until they get up to, oh, maybe 50 or 60 pounds, and then they'll do a head-to-tail like elephants in the circus where they'll just go around in a circle, comfortable, just kind of generating their own energy, going around and around. They'll still bite, you know, out in a daisy chain, putting a cast along the side of a daisy chain and bringing it along in the direction the fish are swimming can be very good. But what the babies do in the mangrove is more kind of mill around, and they'll kind of go in a circle, but not as, say, organizes the big fish.
So in the mangroves, will they act more like a bass or a pike in their attack mode?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
okay.
Definitely. They won't necessarily just hold in a spot unless there's a little current running through a little lagoon or lake, but they'll cruise slowly and then double back and go back under the mangrove roots, pop back out, or go around an island several times. So they're usually on a sort of a slow prowl. I don't necessarily think they're on the real bite when they do that, but they'll for themselves, but they'll still hit a fly. I think they're just kind of cruising around, filing some information away, because there's a lot of night feeding done by tarpon, and I think they just kind of keep a set routine of areas they like to explore and check out, and they'll definitely be back at night.
One of the questions that came in on the Internet is Travis Daly in Clarksville, Tennessee. He said he's read that when fishing for large tarpon on the flats, angler must provoke the fish to take the fly. Do baby tarpon take flies more readily, or do you have to provoke them also?
Well, I would say they take the fly very readily, and if it's moving, they hit it. They'll hit it on the sink. Yeah, they're definitely more of an opportunistic feeder. A few things apply in baby tarpon fishing that apply to big fishing, and that is the angle of the cast, and this is fairly basic. You know, if you have a fish coming at you and you cast straight at it, that's a pretty darn good cast. You can pump the fly like a cockroach or something to get a little action out of it, move it, suspend it, move it, move it, and that fish has almost no option except to open its mouth and eat it because you're right on line. And as you make a bigger angle to the fish, you know, the greatest angle being 180 degrees, which would be fairly ridiculous, but from 90 degrees on up to straight on, you improve your chances of a strike as you get closer and closer to straight on. So maybe 15-20% angle from the front of the fish on both sides is your prime zone. And babies are the same way. They like it that way. If you strip to the fish, they generally spook. If you strip away from the fish, they'll generally hit it. Big tarpon are just a little more finicky.
So it's the basic principle of most bait fish don't swim at their predators, right?
Yeah,
they swim away.
That would apply.
Yeah, so that's what's spooky, is something coming at you. Yeah. You talked about setting the hook earlier, so we got the picture on that. In fighting the fish, and we do have a question from Bob Todd in Frazeesburg, Ohio. He said when he was younger, he watched a lot of tarpon fishing. Did the baby tarpon hit as hard and jump out of the water like the adults do? Do that little tail wag? And
I would say relative to size, it's identical. The same kind of accelerating, open mouth take, swirl, big strong hits. I think that is part of the attraction of tarpon fishing, is the great strikes for one thing, followed by usually multiple big noisy jumps. I read somewhere recently that a tarpon was hooked in Florida that jumped 12 feet out of the water. Now, if you look right now at your ceiling, which is generally 7 feet, that's a long way for a tarpon to be out of the water. So they have amazing leaping ability, but they also have that down-and-dirty strength and sort of durability, almost like a jack that can just keep pounding away and wearing you out. Long runs, jumps, and power. So it's good all-round fish.
What do you treat them any differently than you would an adult tarpon as far as when the fish jumps? We have a question from Mike McEwen in South Africa, and they must have tarpon down there. And he says, do you lower your rod and allow for slack like you do with the big fish to keep the fly seated in the mouth, or is there a different tactic you use?
Yeah, I think with a barbless hook, I think of having light resistance or pressure on a jumping fish, not total slack, but getting in the habit of a small bow or a little give to a jumping fish, jumping tarpon of any size, is great practice for when you get on a big fish, because they can twist and body slam a leader and pop a leader or fling a fly out with their shaking head. So I think getting into some routines due to repetition, which is the great thing about baby tarpon, you have cast to stripping position, stripping, 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 seeing the strike, waiting, setting. I kind of like to think of it as sort of an athletic stance. I fish left foot forward, right foot back, and kind of bend over a little bit. So when I stand up, I'm bringing my line towards me 3 feet, and I'm in a kind of an athletic, good balance if the boat's moving, and I can really kind of focus on what's going on. I'm not standing up straight where a little rock in the boat, I have to get balance in the boat. So I get kind of, kind of like a runner about to run a race, and get a good base, set the hook. If I get jumps, yes, I'll give it a little bit of line, but not a ton on a baby tarpon, just a little bit. That's to sort of reinforce the habit of bowing to a big fish.
And any other tips on fighting the fish? And again, trying to keep health in mind of the fish itself as far as bringing it in.
Well, I think babies, they don't fight forever. So you get 3 or 4 or 5 nice little jumps, some runs, and if it's a 7 to 12 pound fish, they're ready to bring to the boat fairly soon. And I like sort of a team effort on landing fish of any size, because if you're fishing a 7 weight rod, a fairly stiff, high modulus graphite rod, pointing the rod straight up at a fish that's straight down near the boat is a good way to break a rod. So I'd rather keep a full arc in the rod, bring the fish in with a big open bend in the rod to someone else who can lead her and then lip the fish like a bass. We sometimes bring gardening gloves. Those little rubber-coated work gloves are great. And because even a smaller fish, when it shakes in your hand, can scuff up your hand with their kind of sandpaper mouth. So gardening glove, lip it, get the fly out, rinse it in the water, get it going, and let it go. And that's about all that's needed. It's basic common sense in fighting those size fish.
Okay. It sounds like, you know, no gaffs are in use or anything like that.
No, I don't even like the boga grip for most fish. Anything that has huge teeth, probably. But have you ever had a boga grip you? I mean, it really hurts. So I don't use those on anything but just the most toothy of fish. And I just sort of hand land and release fish like that.
Mm-hmm. So they don't have any teeth that you really need to worry about?
No,
as far.
Just sort of sandpapery little teeth, yeah. But they fray up your leader, and they'll chew up a fly pretty fast. But no, you don't have anything to worry about with your hands.
What are some of the common mistakes you see others make, or the mistakes that you make when you're fighting a tarpon and you lose a fish? Anything in particular?
No, not really. I think you get into kind of a groove once you've kind of got a good strip set and get the fish on the reel. A small fish, and I mean really like a 20-inch tarpon, I just strip them in. Strip fight them. It's kind of fun. Get them in, get them off. Look for some other fish. Most fish, though, above that get on the reel. And some, if the fish starts to run at you, be able to stop reeling and strip fast and then be ready for a jump. Just being coordinated and comfortable with your tackle. It's all pretty straightforward.
Well, I was going to say, you don't have to chase them with the boat as you do the adults, it sounds like, because of their size and so forth.
I'll mention one other thing, and that is, if you're with a person that you fish with on a regular basis, the boats that we use were long ponga-style boats. It's very easy for two people to fish at once, which is nice, because if someone's up in the bow and time's ticking along, you know, it gets a little boring sometimes just sitting there. So we usually put one person in the front, one towards the back, and you might have a school of fish on the left side, then on the right side, and doubles are fairly common, so if you're with a person you've cast with before, especially out of a drift boat or something, and you understand their style, it's very easy to fish two out of a boat.
Oh, that sounds good. Yeah, it is difficult, I know, when we're down in the Keys, you know, basically only one person is fishing at a time, and that gets expensive, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you're paying per boat, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, time to wrap things up here, Brian. When we return, we're going to be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, 1-year subscription to Fly Fisher Magazine, and a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers. So, folks, stay tuned to see if you're going to win. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving the battles of all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing and powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and a support network, which in turn renews spirit and the hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout, flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and learn how you can support their retreats, visit reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reeling, and then the word and, healingmidwest.org. Or call them at 866-237-5725. Well, just a quick reminder to everybody before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. And find the link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that and leave your comments. Well, now it's time to give away the prizes that we have here and do our drawings. So let me bring that up here. Now, to qualify for the drawings, you'd have to fill out the survey form that we have on the site. It's a little late to do that now, but make sure you do it on the upcoming shows so that you can have a chance at winning one of these great prizes. Well, the first thing that we're going to do is draw for a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, always a great gift. To learn more about the Federation, you can go to fedflyfishers.org. That's fed, F-E-D, flyfishers.org. So we're going to draw for a 3-year membership with the Federation of Fly Fishers, and that be our winner of Frank. Frank Dizel, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, in British Columbia, but Frank put up a bunch of questions tonight, so he's very, very deserving, that's for sure. So great, Frank. Well, congratulations. And now we'll pick a winner for the 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and that would be Daniel Gilliam in Virginia. Daniel Gilliam in Virginia. And if you want to learn more about Fly Fusion magazine, it's flyfusionmag.com. Flyfusionmag.com, a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada. So that's those drawings. And now, those of you that are ready, willing, and able here to submit your questions online, I mean your answers online to our question, for a $20 gift certificate that you can use Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado, either at their shop or on their website. And their website is frontrangeanglers.com. So, Brian, I want you to help me out here a little bit, but I'm going to ask, my question is, what did Brian say he thought the primary food source, and I think this was both for humans and for tarpon in Campeche Bay was. What was the primary food source that was most prevalent in the bay there that tarpon feed upon? So first person with the answer, their name and location, we'll check with Brian to make sure that it is the correct answer, and they'll win that $20 gift certificate. So, Brian, I'm here checking now to see. And I get an answer from Travis Daly in Clarksville, Tennessee, and he says shrimp. Is that it, Brian?
That is correct.
That's it. Okay, well, Travis, you're a winner of our $20 gift certificate with Front Range Anglers. Congratulations. And, Travis, I need you to send me either online like you just did your email address so that I can email you and request information from you so we can get this to you. Or you can email your address to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and we'll get you taken care of. Well, Brian, again, it was a pleasure talking with you tonight, and I'm ready to go down there. Chris, I was ready to go down there before the show, but now I'm convinced, and sounds like a fun time. Thanks for sharing all your experience with us tonight.
That's been my pleasure, Roger. Feel free to call me anytime.
Great, great. Well, we will do that, and with all your adventures, I'm sure there's much to talk about in the future. So. Well, our next broadcast will be on July 2nd at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. In that show, we're going to be interviewing Mike Reeser, and our topic for the show will be Roosters in the Surf. Mike Reeser will share his newly discovered fly fishing techniques in hooking and landing roosterfish in the surf. Consider this the advanced course in stalking roosterfish that you won't find anywhere else. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Flats Time Charters, Housatonic River Outfitters, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. And don't forget to visit our website and sign up. Make sure you received all the announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.